Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush, Friday interview edition. And guys, this week, it's a very special treat. I had a bit of a documentary filmmaking legend in the office here in Atlanta. He's doing a press tour, Mr. Joe Berlinger. He made a documentary early in his career called Brother's Keeper that was one of the first big documentaries in my life early on in college that I watched. If you haven't seen it, highly recommend it. It's on my top 10 list of all-time documentaries that I put out a few years ago, and has since gone on to make a great career as a documentarian. He did the Paradise Lost movies. I'm sure a lot of you have seen these, following the story of the murders in the West Memphis Three. He made the Metallica documentary. He made a great documentary on Whitey Bulger. One thing I did not even get to ask him about was this fantastic TV show that he directed a bunch of episodes on called Iconoclasts, which I used to love that show. But we were short on time today. He was on a press tour, so we didn't have a lot of time. In fact, we did not even get to his film pick, but I'll go ahead and plug that anyway. It's called Salesman, one of the classic documentaries released in 1969. Cinema Verite that follows the story of these Bible salesmen in the late 60s in the United States. Really, really good film that we didn't get to because we just talked a lot about documentary filmmaking in general. It's rare that I have someone of his caliber in here and can pick his brain about documentaries. And so we did that. And we also talked the reason he's on this press tour about his great new film on Netflix, Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil and Vile, which is the – not documentary, everyone. His second foray into scripted feature filmmaking, the story of Ted Bundy as played by Zac Efron. Really, really good film, everybody. You should check it out. Releases 2 weeks from today on May 3rd. It takes an approach that I really appreciated, which is to say told from the story of some of the living victims of Ted Bundy and not does not glorify him. And in fact, it's not even a very violent film. It doesn't show a lot of that stuff. A lot of courtroom drama, really, really good stuff. So check out Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil and Vile on Netflix starting in 2 weeks. And just dive into Joe Berlinger's career. Really, really amazing stuff that he's done. And it was a great, great honor to sit with him. So here we go with Joe Berlinger on documentaries. So, yeah, I saw the film last night, actually.
Oh, cool. At the thing or?
No, if I had known it was screening last night, I might have been able to make it.
It was a really nice screening.
Yeah, it was really good, man. Yeah. Congratulations.
Oh, thanks.
And we'll talk about that in a minute, but I am curious to talk a little bit about, like, we've never had we've only covered one documentary on this show so far. One person, a good friend of mine picked, Vernon Florida. And
classic.
Yes, obviously. And but we've never had a documentary filmmaker of your caliber.
How come?
You know, there aren't many of you.
Well, there's plenty of doc makers out there doing great work.
You're a bit of a legend, and you sort
of – a legend in my own mind.
You sort of also represent my own sort of journey with documentaries, and that I really started in college, like, deep diving, and Brother's Keeper was – one of the very first ones that I dug into and sort of changed the way – that and Thin Blue Line, obviously, changed the way I sort of looked at documentaries.
Cool, so. Yeah. No, that was a special time. You know, in the early – late 80s, early 90s, there was a couple of us trying to change documentary each in our own way. You know, Errol Morris, of course, with Thin Blue Line, which was hugely influential to me, you know, was pushing the envelope with documentary – by embracing recreations and making them cinematic. That was new.
Right.
Michael Moore was, you know, on-camera filmmaker, putting yourself on camera and being a curmudgeon for social justice, you know, that was new.
Yeah.
And I think what we were trying to do with Brothers Keeper is to craft a documentary that kind of looked and feels like, you know, a narrative film. Not narrative in the sense that it's fictional, because obviously as a journalist and a documentarian, you're still tethered to the truth and you must honor the truth, which means you can't put words in people's mouths and you can't overly manipulate chronology. I say overly manipulate because any documentarian who says they don't play with chronology is, you know, not telling you the truth, because, you know, documentaries are a compression of time. You know, Brothers Keeper was a 3-week murder trial.
Right.
So the only objective reality to watch is 3 weeks of my dailies of the murder trial. You're trusting the filmmaker to take that material and condense it into a narrative. And so because of my and Bruce Sanofsky's belief that all filmmaking, including documentaries, are subjective, that doesn't mean they're not truthful, but every film is subjective because you're making a zillion subjective choices from what you put in the film and what you leave on the cutting room floor, how you frame a shot when you're shooting it, the days we weren't there to cover something because it was kind of a weekend endeavor. You know, every film is a series of thousands of subjective decisions. So why not embrace that? Still be truthful. You got to tell a real story. But why not borrow from the narrative filmmaker's toolbox and do things like an evocative opening title sequence, which we use, which all of these things I'm saying now, like filmmakers today are like, well, what are you talking about? That's what documentaries are, but not in the late 80s.
You're so right, yeah.
You know, so we'd use this evocative opening title sequence, and which some of the, you know, the then leaders of documentary back then were like, well, you can't have an opening title sequence like that. That's not a documentary.
Yeah.
And then a simple thing. We hired these incredible musicians, Jay Unger and Molly Mason, to do this fiddle music. We did an original score for a documentary, which again, today is like so common. You know, young filmmakers are like, what is he talking about? That's a documentary. But back then, using a music score was criticized as being subjective because you're helping people feel a certain way. Well, that's what all films are inherently subjective. And so we kind of push the envelope. And it's also being conscious of narrative structure, classic narrative structure, which means selectively withholding the information until the right dramatic moment.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we gravitated towards a murder trial is that a murder trial has perfect dramatic structure. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Right.
There's a protagonist and an antagonist vying for the truth. And by the end of the movie, you know, the protagonist is changed in some way. That's the classic definition of drama.
Potential twists, of course.
Exactly. So I think that was our little contribution. And, it's gratifying. There's so many younger filmmakers and not so younger filmmakers now who have said that Brothers Keeper kind of made them want to become a filmmaker, like Morgan Spurlock, Brett Morgan, Simon Kilmurry. All of them saw Brothers Keeper in a movie theater and said, that's what I want to do. So that's been nice to hear.
Yeah, it was so great. Boy, I have a million questions after that. After that bit. Maybe let's just start with where did you start and why documentaries? What, like, you as a kid, how's that seed planted?
Yeah. Well, you know, I wish I could say that this was my lifelong ambition and that I always wanted to be a documentarian. The truth is it was like so much of my life, it was kind of coincidental. Although I do subscribe to the definition of luck, you know, as opportunity meets preparation.
You know, so
basically taking advantage of the opportunities presented to me. But when I was in college, I had, you know, I didn't go to film school.
What college?
I went to Colgate University.
Okay.
And there was my senior year, there was a film professor who came for the first time to have a film class, but not a major or a department, a guy named John Connect, who's still a friend of mine. And he turned me on to film, but I never thought it would be a career choice because I just wasn't in that mindset. And I was a language major in college, proficient in a number of languages, and I was a German major and fluent in German. And so my only goal in college was to figure out how I could get a decent paycheck, using languages so that I could live in Europe. That was my goal. I wanted to live in Europe and speak languages and get and somehow get paid. That was the lofty goal.
That's great.
And so I bluffed my way into a job at Ogilvy and Mather, which is one of the big international ad agencies, and they shipped me over to Frankfurt to coordinate some shoots because I spoke some languages and they were looking for a young American who spoke some languages. And literally the first time I was ever on a set, the first time I ever saw a production was for a American Express commercial shooting in Germany. And I was like the young production coordinator.
Right.
And that's when the light bulb went off. I was like, oh, I like this film, TV. And then that also coincided with Jim Jarmusch's Stranger Than Paradise was playing in Germany.
Wow.
And
what
so
a
I
great, great
and
film.
And so I walked into a theater in Germany and watched this film that just kind of blew me away.
Yeah.
And I thought, I could do that. I mean, not you know what I'm saying.
It felt
accessible. That was the charm of that movie.
Absolutely.
It just felt accessible. And so I got to a point in my career in advertising in Germany where I felt like if I didn't go back to New York and try to get into the film business, I would never go back because I kept getting, I was moving up the ladder at Ogilvy and I was becoming like an international ad guy,
right.
A certain kind of international ad guy that I was going to be.
Uh-huh.
and that was, that was appealing to me because that was my goal. I wanted to figure out a way to live abroad and speak languages. But this desire to explore film, I felt if I don't leave soon, I'll never do it. So I convinced Ogilvy to ship me back to New York. I didn't tell them I was planning on figuring out how to get into the film business. But so I came back to New York. Now I was like a full-fledged producer on American Express in New York, and we hired the Maisel brothers, the famous documentarians who did Gimme Shelter and Salesman and Grey Gardens. So we hired the Maisel brothers to shoot these unscripted television commercials, which now is a common genre of commercials, documentaries.
So that was going on back then, huh?
This was one of the first times.
Really?
I can't take credit for it. It was the ad agency creatives who said, let's do documentary-style commercials, but it was relatively new.
Yeah.
So I was just on that job, and we hired the Maisel brothers, and I kind of hit – and I was only about 26 at the time. We kind of hit it off, and in particular, I hit it off with David Maisel. He sadly passed a few years later.
Right.
He was the brother who passed away early in the mid-50s. But I kind of hit it off with them, and they were digging the fact that they were getting serious money to do a documentary-style commercial because back then there was no big tradition of, like, fully funded documentaries the way it is now.
Sure.
So they were looking for a way to get more TV commercial business. I was looking for a way to get into the film business. And so I started working for them as their executive producer for commercials, which was just a glorified sales job where I basically went from ad agency to ad agency to convince advertisers to – or the agency people who represented the advertisers to try real people commercials, which became a flourishing genre in the 90s. But the irony is that I was not looking to get into documentary. I didn't have a particular love of documentary.
Oh, wow,
You know, I wanted to just get into film.
Uh-huh.
And I've always joked that, had the creatives on that American Express commercial decided they wanted to have like some big budget fantasy commercial and they hired Ridley Scott to shoot it. And if I had hit it off with Ridley Scott at lunch one day as a 26-year-old,
he'd be making sci-fi films.
maybe I'd be in Hollywood with a different career arc, which is true. But on the other hand, I also, now that I've lived my life for the last three decades, as a filmmaker, I look back and I believe things happen for a reason. And my life as a documentarian, I think, was meant to be. And I've had amazing experiences dropping into the lives of people.
Yeah,
whether it's a week for a commercial or 3 years with a band like Metallica or two decades covering the Paradise Lost story. There's nothing like showing up with a camera and being able to meet people that you would normally never get to meet and experience things that that you're invited to experience because you're documenting it. So, the fact that I became a documentarian in hindsight, I don't think is as coincidental as it was, but it kind of was on another level.
Yeah, that That's not the answer I expected. I thought you were going to say, you know, from a child, I had a burning desire to tell the truth and to.
Well, I mean, that's one of the reasons that, you know, I didn't have, for reasons because certain people are living and I don't want to get too deep into it. You know, I did grow up in a tough environment and I did get a sense of social injustice and I did have, it did instill in me a desire to like right some wrongs. Mm-hmm. But that didn't kind of wake up until after I was already a filmmaker. In fact, Brother's Keeper was purely an aesthetic experience of wanting to push the documentary form and had no social justice component to it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until Paradise Lost where that gene for social activism kind of woke up because, I mean, actually with Paradise Lost, I thought we were making a film about guilty teenagers because, you know, we showed up a week after the West Memphis Three. Of course, they weren't called the West Memphis Three back then. They were called, you know, rotten, satanic teen killers.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
But we showed up a week after they were arrested. The trial was still 7 months away. We embedded in that community. And for the first 3 months of doing Paradise Lost, we thought we were making a film about guilty teenagers because all the press out of Arkansas, I mean, this is, of course, predated the internet, really, or the internet was just starting. But, you know, there was still like regular press and local press, which there is, of course, now, but a different era.
Yeah.
You know, and all the press coming out of Arkansas was that these guys were definitively guilty, that a confession had been printed in the newspaper. Of course, nobody knew that that confession was multiple different parts from a succeeding number of statements that until they got it right. And then the confession was actually kind of just the highlights of multiple statements, which we learned later in the trial. And, you know, the police were saying on a scale of 1 to 10, the evidence is an 11. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we had no reason to think we weren't making a film. And in fact, it was Sheila Nevins at HBO, the great documentary, you know, the mother of documentary, you know, I mean, she's so, you know, Sheila was so responsible for the modern documentary being what it is today. I mean, HBO was kind of the first people in the game.
Sure.
And a lot of people owe what it's become, I think, to her work. But she wanted a teen killing, teen satanic ritual murder film.
Right.
That's what we thought we were making a film about. And we went down and spent the first couple of months embedded in that community, mainly with the families of the victims. We thought we were telling their horrible tragedy, and we were, of course, but we thought we were telling their story of these rotten kids. And finally, after about 3 months of negotiations, we were able to get access to the West Memphis Three, who were in county jail awaiting trial. And, you know, with great trepidation, we walked in thinking we were interviewing these rotten kids. And by the time the interviews were over, just like 1 + 1 was not equaling two. It just, it's not like a light bulb went off and I said, oh my God, they're innocent. It just didn't feel right.
Yeah,
and that started this journey. In particular, I remember interviewing Jason Baldwin, who was Damien, you know, Damien Echols was the alleged ringleader and his friend Jason Baldwin was involved. And he was this sweet little 16-year-old kid with a squeaky voice. And, you know, I looked at his tiny little wrists during the interview and I kept looking at his wrists and thinking about the prosecution's story that he's the guy who wielded this 10-inch serrated hunting knife and castrated one of the boys. And I just – it just didn't feel right to me. It's just like I can't – you know, Damien was honestly harder to read because he was kind of enjoying the attention. And
he was
poking people back because he was kind of outraged. And,
provocative.
Know, and so I couldn't quite tell – just from those initial conversations from his standpoint. But talking to Jason really kind of convinced me that something was not right here. And of course, that started this journey. And by the time it got to trial, I couldn't imagine that these guys would actually be convicted. But then we witnessed this, you know, literally this modern day witch hunt where Stephen King novels and Metallica lyrics are being introduced as the main evidence as to why these kids were teen killers. You know, no forensic evidence of any value, no blood at the crime scene. It was the, it was like this crazy witch hunt. And at the end of Paradise Lost, you see Damien Echols being chained up and led off to death row and Jason Baldwin being chained up to life without parole sentences. You know, the Miss Kelly trial, he was, you know, was the first half of the film and he's been sent off to to prison, but it's really that moment where Damien is being chained up and led off at the end of the movie, where you know the light bulb goes off that we've just witnessed this incredible miscarriage of justice. Mm-hmm. This 18-year-old boy is going off to death row for a crime that we were convinced he didn't commit. You know, the jury heard nothing but garbage.
Yeah.
And that's when the social activist gene in me kind of woke up,
right,
that filmmaking can be used for social, mm-hmm, justice, and we committed ourselves to like telling that story.
Yeah, it seems some of the most interesting documentaries to me, or now some of the true crime podcasts like S-Town or Sherman's March or Vernon, Florida, or your films start out as something and end up being something else.
Yes.
What is it about, or how important is that for a documentarian to not have that agenda and to be open to, you know, changing mid-course?
Critical. I mean, that's the number one thing I tell most aspiring filmmakers. On the one hand, you have to be prepared, mm-hmm, you know. So it's not like I'm saying don't prepare and understand what you need to do for the day. Of course, you need to have a game plan. You need to know what your questions are in your interviews. But, like, be prepared to just change on a dime. Otherwise, you're going to miss the story. HBO wanted a teen – this was our first commercial assignment after, mm-hmm, Brother's Keeper. And the person hiring us wanted a teen killing teens killing little boys movie,
right,
in a satanic ritual. And in fact, when I called her up after that first interview with Jason Baldwin to give her a report that actually I'm not sure this is a teen killer movie, but rather a wrongful, at that time, wrongful arrest, not wrongful – it wasn't wrongful conviction yet. I was half afraid she was going to cancel the,
yeah,
movie. But to her credit, Sheila said, you know, that sounds even more interesting. Continue. But the lesson to filmmakers is you must be prepared. I've never started a film that hasn't turned out to be something far different than what it begins to be.
I mean, right,
Metallica was just supposed to be this little assignment of shooting some B-roll for, right, the band as a favor to the band because they gave us music for Paradise Lost,
yeah,
for free. So in return, they were going into the studio and we were just going to cover a little, you know, behind the scenes activity.
And that just grew from there, huh?
And that just like,
wow,
blew up into, you know, into something that was totally unexpected. So you have to be prepared. And interestingly, since I think eventually we're going to talk about Extremely Wicked, which was basically my first feature. You know, I did a feature 20 years ago. Well, we can talk about that or not. That didn't go so well, and not because of me. I mean, partially because of me, but the studio put that movie in a meat grinder and didn't believe in my director's cut.
Right.
And the results are well known. But on this movie, Extremely Wicked, what I brought, I think, to the table as a filmmaker is exactly what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Is like not being so locked in. You must prep and know what you want to do for, mm-hmm, the day, but be prepared to change. And so I felt my goal as a director on a feature film was to create an environment where everyone felt free and secure and unintimidated to, mm-hmm, just create whatever magic they felt. And even though I might have had an initial instinct about which way I wanted to go, I was free enough and encouraged everybody on the movie to be free enough that let's create something, and if something is better, let's go for that. And that grew directly out of my documentary aesthetic that I've,
right,
I've never started a movie in documentary that hasn't greatly changed while it's unfolding, and that's the whole nature. You know, you jump out a window in document in verit. I mean, there's certain type of documentaries that doesn't apply to. If you're doing a historical look at,
right,
like, you know, the
kid stays in the picture or something like,
exactly,
that.
Exactly. If you're doing, yeah, a biographical film, but even that has its surprises. But generally speaking, if you're doing something about historical or biographical, it's less subject to change.
Mm-hmm.
But verite documentaries where you're following a story as it's unfolding and, you know, you want to be surprised because that surprise is then communicated to the audience. So we've always said, you know, for these films, you jump out a window and you hope there's a mattress on the other side to catch you.
Right.
But you have to embrace the fact that you're covering a story where you don't know the outcome.
Yeah, I really love seeing the broad swath of how documentaries have changed in the last like 30 years.
Yeah.
from just sort of the straight up verite style, which we still see today, to things like Kid Stays in the Picture.
Yeah.
And then you've got like Ken Burns on one side and Kid Stays in the Picture on the other and everything in between.
Yeah.
I'm curious though, with your experience, like, do you feel like have documentaries lost their way in any way, or is it just great to see so many different things happening?
Well, I think – I mean, that's a great question. I think it depends on the filmmaker. There's been some irresponsible filmmaking. There's some filmmaking where there's an agenda to the exclusion of being objective.
Right.
You know, there are three basic impulses, I think, that drive a documentarian, you know, and they're not mutually exclusive, but they can bump into each other,
mm-hmm.
which is some people come into filmmaking purely for storytelling reasons. Some people come into filmmaking for journalism. You know, they
right.
want to journalistically portray something. And sometimes filmmakers come in because they want to advocate for a cause.
Mm-hmm.
And I think advocacy, storytelling, and journalism sometimes are at odds with each other.
Right.
For example, what makes a great story is sometimes selectively withholding information until the right dramatic moment. If you push that too far, then you're not being a good journalist.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, and I think the biggest problem with some advocacy films is that they're afraid of showing all sides of a subject. And I think people feel sometimes cheated or being lectured to. For example, in Paradise Lost, we showed all sides of the subject to the point where 20% of the people who saw the movie thought that they were watching a movie about guilty teenagers because
right.
we didn't bang our point of view over your head. But what you get by treating the audience like a jury,
mm-hmm.
which has been my basic filmmaking philosophy, where I don't bang my point of view over your head. Of course, the point of view of the film is with every decision, but you're leading the audience in a way that feels less pointed
mm-hmm.
than some other more advocacy-driven films where they're afraid to show both sides.
Right.
And so if you're in an audience, whether you're at home on TV or literally in an audience, and the filmmaker is, you know, lecturing to you a very overt point of view,
mm-hmm.
it can be fascinating, but that's a passive viewing experience. You're being told by the filmmaker what to think.
Mm-hmm.
In an experience like Brothers Keeper or Paradise Lost, where we kind of evolved this style, you're hearing all sides and you're being forced to confront the information and make your own decision as to what you're seeing. And I
right.
think that's the best – for me – and look, I don't want to tell other people how to make a film. For me, that's the best way to see a film
mm-hmm.
and to make a film is for the viewer to be in the very active as opposed to passive
mm-hmm.
position of evaluating. You know, so for Brothers Keeper, we see Damien strangely combing his hair in a mirror that's used to look for bombs. And so you think to yourself, God, he is a little narcissistic and weird. Could he be capable of these things?
Yeah.
He's not pounding his fist denying that he did these crimes. That's a little odd for somebody who's
uh-huh.
innocent. But the price – so the price you pay, I think, is maybe 20%. And that was my feeling over the years. Like 20% of the people have seen Paradise Lost thought they were guilty, that they
uh-huh.
had watched a movie about weird teenagers who – must have done these crimes. But what you get by rewarding the audience for their intelligence is that 80% of the people not only believed that they had witnessed this outrageous miscarriage of justice,
mm-hmm.
they were allowed to come to that conclusion themselves by evaluating the information in the film instead of being lectured to by a filmmaker.
Right.
And so when you come to the conclusion yourself – after evaluating the pros and cons that a miscarriage of justice has taken place,
mm-hmm.
that's a much more persuasive and emotional experience. And as a result, literally, the films get a lot of credit for having gotten the guys out of prison, and the celebrities have gotten a lot of credit who watched the movies for getting the guys out of prison, like Johnny Depp and Eddie Vedder.
Right,
and all of that is true, and I don't want to take away from the film, and I don't want to take away from the celebrities. But really what got those guys out of prison is the tens of thousands of regular people who were so moved by that movie
uh-huh.
that they banded together and formed this Free the West Memphis 3, you know, kind of grassroots movement, literally, you know, bankers and, you know, poster makers and whatever
right.
people did for a living would take their vacations in Arkansas to
wow.
demonstrate at appeal hearings.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's the power of letting people decide for themselves what they're viewing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, great documentary that's out now on HBO is the Leaving Neverland film. But I did, you know, and it's a powerful film, but I disagree with the filmmakers that they shouldn't have had the other side, because when you have the other side, give them enough rope to hang themselves.
Right.
Allow the viewer to hear both sides so that they can come to the conclusion that they came to. You know, I made a movie about pollution in the Amazon called Crude.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of the activists who were involved in that case were very upset with me that I allowed Chevron to have their point of view in the film.
Really?
But only by showing both sides can viewers come to their own conclusion.
Absolutely.
And I mean, that's been my kind of guiding principle.
I'm curious about the documentarian community. As an outsider, I guess I like to think that everyone kind of knows each other and supports each other. But how does that work? Are people connected, and is there competition? Or
well, of course, there's competition. You know,
it's got to be a different thing though than traditional.
I would think
narrative filmmaking.
Having just finished doing a narrative film and having done documentaries, I will say the documentary community is a much, I hate to say it, and again, there's great people everywhere and bad people everywhere. So you've asked me a generalized question, so
right.
I'm going to give you a broad. I'm going to paint with a broad generalized. You know, I think people in the feature film world take themselves far too seriously.
Uh-huh.
Things are, you know, cloaked in secrecy, and people, you know, it's like, guys, we're not curing cancer here.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I think for the most part, documentarians are deeply caring. People who are there to shine a light on a social abuse. Are there egomaniacs in documentary? Of course. Are there people who are jealous and competitive and petty? Of course, because
right.
you find that in everything. But by and large, I think the documentary community is a much closer knit group of people who try to support and help each other
mm-hmm.
a little more than on the scripted side of things. And I think, you know, some documentarians are trying to cure cancer, you know,
right.
whereas like some of the stupid, like pretentious behavior on the feature film side sometimes makes me just scratch my head, you know.
Yeah.
That having been said, I greatly enjoyed doing the movie and would love to do another movie, but you asked the question.
So. Yeah. I mean, let's talk about the movie. It's, you know, you referenced your previous foray into feature filmmaking.
Yes.
With the Blair Witch
The much loved Blair Witch 2 that people point to as one of the most successful sequels in cinema history.
Oh, really?
No, I'm teasing.
Oh, okay.
It was much maligned at the time, you know.
Well, I mean, there was a lot of time between that and this.
Yeah.
Did you think you didn't want to do that again ever? Like,
oh, that's
what
scary.
About the process?
Well, that first film, look, I hope one day Lionsgate, which bought Artisan, will allow me to release my director's cut.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the very least, it's not to say my director's cut of Blair Witch 2 will be any better received per se than what was released, but at least it would be my movie.
Right.
And then at least I would
That's
know.
That's got to be frustrating.
Then I would, you know, the only thing worse than having a movie be spit upon by the public is, you know, and in such a profound way as that movie was, is the only thing worse is that when it wasn't even your cut, you know,
right.
I purposely created a movie that was a satire and was making fun of the whole idea of doing a sequel, because there was a lot of venom about doing a
right.
sequel, because the original Blair Witch was this little indie phenomenon.
Sure.
That, you know, this little $140,000 movie became this mega grossing, you know, worldwide phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And so within a year, a sequel was out, and a lot of people resented that. And I underestimated the amount of venom that anything called Blair Witch 2
mm-hmm.
would engender. In fact, they recently tried to forget my movie, and they came out with a Blair Witch, you know, a Blair Witch prequel about a year or two ago. And
oh,
that,
really?
That actually did worse than my film. you know, my film still grossed $54 million. I mean, the irony is my film grossed $54 million worldwide and did $25 million on DVD, because it was the era of like
right.
DVD.
Uh-huh.
And our film was a dual disc where it had the movie on one side and the soundtrack on the other. And that alone did $25 million.
Wow.
You know, so, but it's considered this epic failure. And I'm like, well, you know, the movie cost $10 million. It grossed $54 million.
Made a lot of money for somebody.
And it did $25 million. It's not that, I mean, but creatively it was considered not good. And that was painful, because I thought I made a really fun, smart movie that made fun of the whole idea
mm-hmm.
of doing a sequel. It was a very pre-Scream, which was very self-reflexive, a pre-Scream self-reflexive movie making fun of the idea of a sequel.
Yeah.
And making fun of the idea that the original Blair Witch – well, the original Blair Witch was making fun of how that movie succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that movie succeeded is that people marketed that movie, artists and marketed that movie as a real documentary. And a lot of people went into the movie theater thinking it's a real documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And I, as a documentarian, found that deeply disturbing.
Sure.
Because first of all, shaking your camera around and shooting terribly is not what a real documentary is. As somebody who's made beautifully crafted films.
Agreed.
And secondly, the really disturbing part of the success of the first movie to me as a real journalist is that, you know, Time, Newsweek, you know, the late night talk shows, everybody, you know, just kind of celebrated the marketing hoax, you know. And to me, it's like, wait, not one article about what are we doing here? We're lying to the public.
Mm-hmm.
We're pretending something's a documentary that it's not. We've duped people into going into a movie theater by pretending it's a documentary. And nobody is pulling back and saying, wait, over the last four decades, you know, since the hallowed days of Edward R. Murrow and CBS News and that sacrosanct, you know, hard line between news and entertainment, we've so blurred the line between entertainment and reality that we're celebrating a hoax as opposed to saying, wait a second. And boy, was that movie and that theme, meaning my original intent, have become so prescient today in a world of fake news, alternative facts, and Fox News and MSNBC just screaming, you know. And I love Rachel Maddow and I love MSNBC for the record. But, you know, we live in a world where everyone just is in their own echo chamber.
Yeah,
and
you could
put up Fox News and NBC, MSNBC on a split screen, and it's just two covering the same story, and it's just two alternative universes. That's what I was making fun of with Blair Witch, and I was doing an edgy adult satire.
Mm-hmm.
And at the 12th hour, the studio took a look at the movie that they had greenlit and got scared and felt it needed to be a traditional horror movie, which is not what I made. And they hired the wrong guy if they wanted a traditional horror movie.
Yeah.
And I was very clear in my intention of what I was trying to do. So they literally, you know, they shot gory recreations, even though I said, hey, the legacy of the first Blair Witch was all the violence happens off screen and now you're showing it. I mean, that's like ridiculous. And I disavowed the movie upon its release, which is a well-known story to some. So I feel confident saying that. You know, so if my own movie had been released, my version of it that didn't have the gory recreations and had a different, you know, the arrangement of the scenes, you know, maybe it would have fared better, maybe not. You know, but at least it would have been my movie that failed instead of somebody's focus group committee making film that ultimately was Blair Witch 2.
Well, why jump back in now? Like, did it at one point were you just like, screw that, I'm not doing that
ever
again?
It was such a miserable experience. Actually, I was, you know, 39 at the time. It was such an epic failure. It was one of the biggest releases of that time. It was released in six countries simultaneously on, like, I think 2,000 screens. It was actually one of the biggest releases in its day. It's been eclipsed since then.
Right.
And, you know, the publicist warned me, you don't want to read these reviews. And I was so anal back then about those types. I want to read the reviews. So in one language after the other, I sat by my fax machine in German, in French, in Spanish, calling me the biggest asshole that ever lived. And I destroyed the franchise. And I literally curled up in a ball and just – I thought my life was over. You know, and one of the lessons I've learned is that, you know, because up until that point, I had gotten nothing but great reviews, Brother's Keeper,
sure.
Paradise Lost.
Yeah.
And so, you know, one of the most important lessons I learned from that experience, if you're going to validate yourself artistically on the way up and believe your reviews, then of course you have to invalidate yourself on the way down as they're calling you all sorts of terrible things.
Yeah.
And so, I basically curled up in a ball and was very depressed, and it was kind of intersecting with, gee, I'm nearing 40 and all this stuff. And my wife, bless her heart, Lauren Eiferman, came into my office because we had two young children at home. And she handed me a copy of Paradise Lost, and she said, here, watch this movie and remind yourself that you're a good filmmaker and get off your ass and start working again.
That's great.
And so I popped in the film, and, you know, the opening title sequence of Paradise Lost is over the murder site to a Metallica song.
So great.
And that's how the Metallica film started. So it kind of popped into my head, oh, yeah, Lars wanted us to do some B-roll, and I told him after the movie was over, meaning Blair Witch, I'd reach out to him. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm going to get back on my feet. I'm going to be a filmmaker again. Uh-huh. So I called Lars, and I said, hey, you want to do that B-roll? And he said, sure, come on out to – you know, we're going to start recording in about a month. Why don't you call Elektra, our record label, get it set up, and come shoot some B-roll? So I went out to San Francisco totally – in fact, Bruce and I had – my longtime filmmaking partner, who sadly passed a few years ago, we had actually broken up as a filmmaking team. I went off, you know, the it's hard having a creative partnership, and it lasted two films, and I was ready to move on, and I went off to do Blair Witch, and, you know, I kind of, you know, in hindsight, I kind of abruptly ended the relationship in a way that didn't feel like abrupt at the time, but it was abrupt. Mm-hmm. And I went off to go do the Metallica film by myself, thinking it was just a corporate assignment, basically.
Right.
I was going to shoot some B-roll that these guys were going to slap on the back of a CD, because Napster and digital was just starting to nip at the heels of the record industry. And the idea of the B-roll was that, you know, the record business, which was about to change drastically 2 years or 3 years later, they were still trying to sell physical CDs. Mm-hmm. And the idea of some bonus 20 minutes of Metallica bonus footage was really all I was going out to do. And I get to San Francisco. I call Lars. Hey, I'm here. And he's, oh, man, I wish I forgot. Sorry, Jason Newsted just quit the band. We're falling apart. And I'm not sure we're going to even record a record. So I was there and we had drinks and I kind of hung out. And then that's when he tells me, yeah, and our management company's hired this shrink. And I'm like, that's when the light – I'm like, oh, okay, can I shoot that? And he looked at me like I was crazy and then kind of liked the idea. And honestly, Lars – you know, Lars is a guy, if he wasn't a, you know, a rock and roll star, he would be a film producer. He loves film and really has some smart things about film to say. So he was also a driving force behind the Metallica film because he – you know, he liked this idea. So somehow I found myself pushing my way into the Ritz-Carlton suite that they were having their first therapy session. And it was really just me.
That's so interesting.
And I'm sitting there holding this camera, filming the, you know, these two icons of male testosterone sharing their feelings. And I'm thinking to myself –
it was really something to see.
And I'm thinking to myself, you know, I don't know what this is going to become, and I don't know why the universe has placed me here. But this is after what I've been through, this is really healthy for me, you know, because what, you know, these guys were going through a creative and existential crisis just like I was. And I just, again, I didn't think, oh my God, I'm going to spend the next 3 or 4 years and make this epic rock and roll documentary. I just was grateful to be in the room to witness what was going on because it was helping me. In fact, it caused me to reflect upon my breakup with Bruce and how I mishandled it.
Right.
And so I called Bruce up and I said, man, you got to get out here. We're going to make this film together. You know, I'm sorry for what I did in the past, and let's make this film together. Again, neither one of us imagining it would be the journey that it became. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we even used the therapy sessions, you know, to help ourselves. Like we go back to the hotel room ourselves and kind of the conversation that we were filming triggered us to have our own little mini therapy sessions and try to repair our relationship and figure out, you know, where it went off the rails. And so, you know, we were lucky enough to continue working together for a little bit after that. I forgot the point I'm trying to make, but you asked why I didn't go back to scripted movies. First of all, it was a horrifying experience to, you know, like on all of my docs, I'm the, you know, whether they're with Bruce and then it's a we, or whether the many films I've done on my own, in my documentary life, I am the author of the work. Mm-hmm. I for the most part, I get final cut. Of course, when you're dealing with networks, they give you suggestions or whatnot.
Right.
Whatnot. But basically, I'm a final cut director in nonfiction. And having had my movie that I thought was great, and everyone left the set thinking, man, we really did something special and unique, having Blair Witch 2 be put in the meat grinder by a bunch of committee idiot studio executives.
Right.
Not – look, there's a lot of great studio executives. I'm not castigating studio executives in general, but the people running Artisan, all they cared about was the IPO of the company that – you know, this was also the IPO craze.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they were trying to take Artisan public, and they just saw dollar signs, and they did not care about the craft of the movie at all, and they were looking for the biggest bang possible, and it was a complete misfire. Thanks to the committee of people meddling in my film, and that scared the shit out of me. It was, you know, so it made me retreat from features for a really long time, because if you can be the author of your own work in nonfiction or be subjected to a bunch of idiots telling you how to make a film in the scripted realm, I decided I'd rather stick with documentary. And I'm glad, because the Metallica film was one of the greatest experiences I've ever had in my life. It came at exactly the right time. You know, the subsequent two Paradise Lost movies, you know, saw the release of the West Memphis 3, which getting people out of prison who are wrongfully convicted, that no greater accolade, you know, than that in terms of feeling like what you're doing has value.
The Whitey Bulger film was great.
Thank you. So I've greatly enjoyed my nonfiction life. But, you know, about 5 years ago, I started, you know, looking at the scripted market again and have been attached to a couple of different projects that, you know, it's not easy getting an indie movie off the ground. I mean, I've been attached to a couple of things that have fallen apart. But it's only fairly recently that I started looking into doing a scripted movie again. And this came along at exactly the right time. And
yeah, it was a great movie. I was really impressed with Zac Efron. Just, man.
He was great.
And I didn't know a ton about him in his earlier career. I saw him in the film Neighbors, though, and thought, man, he's actually really funny.
Yeah.
And then he continues to sort of impress me with how good he is at different things.
Yeah, you know.
Despite being just so perfect and handsome.
Yeah.
It's like I'm kind of angry at him.
No, you can't be angry
at him. He's talented, too.
I mean, you know, one reason you can't be angry at Zach, and I hope he doesn't mind me saying this, is it's really hard to be him. I mean, I'm sure. Like at Sundance, we were on, the little press tour at Sundance, and he literally can't walk on the street without being mobbed. And that sounds – maybe the sounds that – that sounds fun, but
no,
it really isn't. I mean, this guy literally can't go in public without 1,000 screaming women of a certain age, like just needing a piece of him.
Yep.
And again, that sounds like some great fantasy for people, but it isn't.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's – it's hard to be Zach.
And he just seemingly wants to do good work at this point.
It's true. And that's – you know, that's the reason I mean, how he came to be – how this whole movie came to be is actually pretty interesting, because you know, I was not – as you know, I did Conversations with the Killer, which is the doc series for Netflix, which is about Bundy.
Right.
And that was already ongoing when I was having lunch with my agent in California, just telling him how cool this – so it's like April of 2017, and I was already doing the doc. And in April 2017, I was having lunch with my agent at CAA, which is Creative Artists Agency, one of the talent agencies, and CAA represents me. And I was explaining how fascinating the Bundy doc series is, because it was based on these audio tapes of his final interviews on death row. And utterly chilling and fascinating. And I was just going on about how cool I think the show is going to be, and disturbing in all the right ways, and like a good lesson for the new generation to not, you know, just assume somebody is good because they look and act a certain way.
Right.
And that's when my agent said, oh, you should read the script called Extremely Wicked. Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil and Vile.
Right.
This script was on what's called the Hollywood Blacklist.
Oh, was it one of those?
Yeah. So the Hollywood Blacklist, for people who don't know, is a list of scripts that executives and producers in Hollywood really like, wish that somebody would make, but nobody's figured out how to get the funding or what the proper –
it's all the best stuff in Hollywood basically.
Yeah, it's the stuff that people – that hasn't been greenlit, but people say, hey, you know, if somebody could figure out how to do that script, it might be good. So he said, you should read the script because you're so immersed in Bundy. And so I read the script, was totally captivated by its unique point of view, i.e. telling the story from the perspective of his longtime girlfriend.
All right. So that was always a part of it. That was a big question for me.
It was a part of it, but I, in ways that I can tell you in a minute, I changed it a little bit. But basically I read the script. I said I loved it and got on the phone with the producer. And again, I've been attached to a couple of things in the last couple of years that take forever to get off the ground.
Yeah.
Like it takes months to attach talent. It takes years to find money. I mean, there's a couple of movies that I'm attached to that started 3 years ago and we still don't have, you know, the full financing yet. So these things take a while, particularly a Hollywood blacklisted script. But in April, I read the script. A couple of weeks later, I got on the phone with a producer named Michael Costigan who controlled the rights to the script.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave him my take. You know, when you want a job as a director of a feature film, you have to give your take,
right,
which means how are you going to do the movie? And so my analysis of why the script wasn't working or wasn't getting made is that the original script, even though the bones of it are very similar to what the final movie is, I made a few very important, I think, changes that got people excited. One is the original script relied upon the audience not knowing it's Ted Bundy, the serial killer, literally until the final scene of the film.
No, interesting.
And which makes for a great read. You know, this guy named Ted, this woman named Liz. In fact, they're unnamed in the movie.
Uh-huh.
You know? So Ted and Liz are having this, great relationship. And then all of a sudden, these legal predicaments start mounting. And so this guy who is so believable and charismatic is falling into this Kafkaesque, you know, series of legal entanglements and that he's a wrongfully accused guy.
Right.
Which is part of the bones of the script, obviously.
Uh-huh.
But what reads well that you don't know it's Bundy until the very end, I think was impractical in reality, because there's no way a movie like this can get made, especially in this day and age of instantaneous information where you wouldn't know it's the Ted Bundy movie. Whether it's Zach or somebody else who signed up, it would be an announcement. And
then it feels a bit like a stunt.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I felt that reads great, but let's lean into the fact that it's Bundy. Let's lean even harder into this POV that, you know, that here's a guy who seduced the American media, seduced the judicial system, and seduced, you know, his live-in girlfriend into thinking that he's a good guy.
Yeah.
And so I leaned into that a little heavier because the film relies upon or the original script relied upon not knowing it's Ted until the very end. It allowed that script to have a much lighter tone. And there is a light tone to the first half of my film, but it gets dark actually pretty quickly and takes a descent into real darkness towards the end. That was my push. Like the film needs to be grounded in we need to do away with this kind of catch me if you can tone of the original script and take it to a darker place and infuse it with a level of reality and embrace the Bundy story points, which included adding things like archival footage, which wasn't part of the original script. So that was my pitch. And again, I think this is baby step number 14 in a multi-year process, and maybe 5 years from now I'd be shooting the movie. But I read the script in April. By the end of April, the producer and I are like, you know, on the same page about what my take is. So we decide to, you know, go out with it. But it just so happened that at the weekly meeting that agents at agencies have, at my agency, it was CAA, my agent mentioned that Joe was taking a run at this script, Extremely Wicked, which all the agents know as a beloved script, a beloved unproducible script.
Right.
And Zac Efron's agent also – Zach is at CAA.
Mm-hmm.
So Zac Efron's agent was at this meeting and said, oh, well, maybe Zach should take a read because he's looking to do something different.
Yeah.
And so I was asked, do you want Zach to read the script, which is a bigger question than it might at first appear. Because when you ask an actor at his level to read the script, it's called a reading offer.
Mm-hmm.
And it means if he takes the time to read the script and says, yes, you're obligated to hire him. So it's not like a casual, hey, do you want to read the script? It's like, do you want to hire this guy if he says yes?
Yeah.
So I had to think for a second. In fact, I was on a I was at the gate at JFK about to fly to South Africa and the doors were closing and I'm reading this email. Do you want Zach to read the script? So I could have waited 36 hours until I got to my hotel.
Yeah.
You know, delayed and thought about it on the flight. But, you know, it just felt like, oh, that's cool. And I said yes almost immediately because I felt, first of all, this is a movie that was going to be made for peanuts.
Right. You know,
the budget was not big. And so for Zach to want to take – and for his agent to be suggesting that this guy take a 99% pay cut, which is basically what he did compared to like Baywatch, that says to me he's really committed. And secondly, if he was willing to pay play with his teen heartthrob image, then that's a level of commitment. And for me as a documentarian, actually playing with that – because for a certain demographic of women, he was – exactly like Bundy, had this, he has this spell over people. And if he was willing to poke a hole in that, that gives me like a piece of reality that I can bring into the movie. And as a documentarian, that's something that I, you know, I felt like gives me some reality to work with. And so he said yes. Oh, sorry. So I land in South Africa and actually I'm going to Namibia. So that's why I say it's a 36-hour journey. I finally get hotel Wi-Fi. I look at my phone and it's an email from my agent saying, hey, Zach read the script already and loves it, which like, whoa, that was quick because sometimes you give scripts to actors and they take months to read.
Sure.
So – we get on the phone, we have a great conversation, we have a couple of conversations, and we decide to, like, let's go for it. And literally the week later, the producer says, let's take it to Cannes. And I'm thinking to myself, this is happening too quickly. This is, like, bizarre.
Right.
You know, Cannes is not just a film festival, but it's a place where movie deals get done, where you sell movies that are yet to be made. And literally – from the day I read the script in early April to May 11th, when the movie was greenlit as a movie, was about 6 weeks. 6 weeks before, I hadn't even heard of a script called Extremely Wicked.
That's crazy.
So it's insane how quickly that – but now I'm stuck, quote unquote, with the problem of I'm in the middle of my documentary and I'm supposed to do a feature at the same time. So it made me a little nervous, but luckily – excuse me – once I approached Lily Collins to be Liz, and she was my first choice, she said a yes immediately too. But she had an availability issue, and Zach had an availability issue, so the movie got pushed to January. So it allowed of 2018. So it allowed me to finish the more or less get the documentary rough cut, and then my team could take over in New York. And then I went off to shoot the movie. And the fact that the two got made at the same time and released at the same time because January 24th – it's all coincidental.
Right.
You know, January 24th is the 30th anniversary of the execution of Bundy. So that's when Netflix decided to release Conversations with a Killer. And so that's the first day of Sundance as well. And my, so my movie Extremely Wicked premiered 2 days later at Sundance after Conversations with a Killer had just been released. And Netflix wasn't part of the picture for the movie. In fact, you know, initial conversations with Netflix was that they weren't interested in it. This is prior to Conversations with a Killer. But Conversations with a Killer did so well immediately that during Sundance, there was all this buzz about the doc and people were loving the movie and we were getting offers for traditional theatrical distribution. But I started talking with Netflix saying, look, you know, the two films together on your service to a global audience would be a great thing. And they agreed. And and so we ended up selling the movie to Netflix at Sundance, but that wasn't part of the original plan.
All right. Well, I wish we had another hour or two.
I know. And we can't talk about documentary or films that you had wanted to talk about.
Oh, that's okay. You know what? This is great. I mean, I rarely get to pick the brain of a documentarian of your stature. So this has been wonderful.
Oh, cool. Appreciate it.
Maybe we can do a part two sometime
in
New York or something.
That'd be awesome.
And thanks for coming in,
hey,
man.
Hey, thanks for having me. This was fun.
All right, everyone. Hope you enjoyed that. Very much an honor to sit down with Joe and pick his brain. I wish we had more time. I'm going to try and do a follow-up in New York City because I had about a gazillion questions about documentaries and the approach and his thoughts on the medium and the form that we couldn't get to because we only had about an hour. But very insightful guy, very talented. I hope you have if you haven't followed his career, watch Brothers Keeper, watch the Paradise Lost films, the Metallica documentary is great. Go check out Iconoclast. All of those are really, really great films. And he's got many, many more in the documentary film world. But definitely check out Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile on Netflix. Drops 2 weeks today on May 3rd. Excellent film. Getting to see Zac Efron stretch his acting chops in directions that I didn't even know he could go. He was great. So I enjoyed the film, and I hope you do too. And big thanks to Joe for coming in here and making some time for me. So that's it, everyone, for this week. Until next time, make a documentary, or maybe I've said that before. So if you did that, make another one. Movie Crush is produced, edited, and engineered by Ramsey Yunt here in our home studio at Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.